when I was on Rejected Princesses, I found this lady. Well, she's not a princess. But the next time that we need, like, just a short little filler story is this chick named Timoclea, I think is how you would pronounce it, from Greece, I think.
Okay.
Somewhere where all these soldiers under Alexander the Great came in and were fighting or something. I don't know. But this soldier comes into her town and rapes her. And she is like, wow, that's a zero. Enough of you and enough of that. So she drags his body out in the middle of the night, throws his body down a well, and then throws rocks down the well on top of him until he dies.
Wait, grabbed it, threw his body out. Was he unconscious?
I don't remember.
We don't remember.
Threw his body down a well. On Rejected Princesses, it's like a comic book or a comic strip that they do of it. And while she's throwing the rocks down a well, all these other women show up with rocks and they're like, do you need any help? And I was like, this is everything. This is so cool. I'm so on board with all of this. Like, throw rocks on top of people. Hell yes. So
throw rocks on top of rapists.
On top of rapists. After you throw their body down a well.
Right.
And then you throw rocks on top of them until they die. Great. But then, obviously, people are like, "You, that's murder. You cannot do this."
What was that?
That's a murder. So they make her go and report to Alexander the Great and, like, explain what happened. And she's on trial, basically, in front of Alexander the Great. And she just says, you know, like, this is what happened, and your soldier treated me horribly, and I defended myself, and, you know, whatever. And Alexander the Great goes, I believe you. Hello! Oh. Hello! So he's like, I am sorry that my soldier treated you in such a terrible way. You're good to go, lady. Get out of here. Amazing. Amazing.
I love wholesome masculinity.
From Alexander the Great, no less. And when I read that, I was like, you know what, Alexander? You are the great. You are the greatest. That is how I feel right now. Okay.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about the Empress Zenobia.
I am so excited.
Yes.
I'm going to be talking to you about Catherine Switzer.
Who's that?
You don't need to know yet.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you later. Okay.
All right. So, Zenobia. This story, a little like Ma Barker from the last episode, but not in a bad, she's not a bad way. She's like Ma Barker in that she has a quick rise and sort of a quick fall.
Okay.
And we do have to kind of set the scene a little bit. Zenobia is born in 240 Common Era.
Wow.
This is about the third century of Roman, you know, existing, of Roman. Great.
The
whatever.
Roman Empire.
Right, the third century of the Roman Empire.
It's the Roman Empire.
It's the Roman Empire. Her name, actually, and what she probably would have gone by was Batzebai, but in Greek, she used the name Zenobia, which means one whose life derives from Zeus.
What? To stake a claim, lady.
Literally.
Way to just be like, literally. Oh, you know what? My father's a god. Peace.
But also, kind of bringing some danger from Hera. Double-edged sword, maybe.
I guess.
But it worked out well for her. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So we actually don't have any existing statues of Zenobia, just inscriptions on the bases where statues could have been or used to be. Most known representations of Zenobia are from coins.
Oh,
and they were minted. The two most well-known collections of records on Zenobia, one is called the Augustan History, and it's from a Byzantine chronicler named Johannes Zonaris, which is kind of a cool name, but it's not really thought to be that accurate.
Like it was a pen name?
Not his name, the histories.
Oh, the histories are not accurate. Okay. Accurate. Right. It's, got it.
But
now
they
I'm
are
there.
The most extensive. So okay. It's kind of like picking and, you know, you got to try and figure out.
Yeah.
So because of that, a lot of the information about her ancestry and her immediate family is scarce mm-hmm. and kind of contradictory. We don't know who her mother was. We don't know who her father was. She may have had a sister. She may have not had a sister. We're not even actually sure of what her racial makeup was or what her nationality makeup was.
Okay.
She was part of Pomerine society, but it was a very diverse society at the mm-hmm. time. It was on the west coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Mm. So trading ports. You're going to have a mix of a lot of different people. What we do know that she's not a commoner. She receives an education that is typical of a Palmyrene girl, noble Palmyrene girl. And she hunted.
Great.
And she was fluent in Egyptian, Greek, and Latin.
Wow.
Now, one of the reasons we know that she was not common is because at the age of 14, she becomes the second wife of the Lord of Palmyra. His name is Odenathus.
Okay.
And it is possible that they were related because, no, it's a noble marriage.
Yeah.
Of course
they're
possibly related.
Okay.
We're just going to kind of skip over all of this uncertainty of the beginning of it and get to her being queen. We do, though, have to explain a little bit about what was happening in Palmyra.
Okay.
At the time. It's a very rich city.
Yeah.
A very powerful city. And when Rome starts, you know, facing all of these political and economic crises as being, you know, on the tail end of an empire bring.
Right.
They realize that they have an opportunity.
Okay.
And in 260, the Persians make their way east and unseat the Emperor Valerian. The Roman Emperor Valerian, actually take him hostage. And actually, we have stories of the emperor being kept for about 6 years as a footstool for the Persian emperor.
Wow.
Literally, we have artwork depicting the Persian emperor stepping on him to get onto his horse.
Wow.
Palmyra at this point is like a city-state within Rome. And mm-hmm. Odenathus says, okay, I will take on the Persians. And he actually successfully pushes back the Persians back to the east. And it said actually that Zenobia is there with him on his campaigns.
I mean, obviously.
Which not only lends to her political know-how and her tactical know-how, but also would have helped endear her to the people, right? Because she's actually there on the front lines, or at least in the battle. He marches against the Persian monarch, Shapur the First. Pushes him back. Odenathus is declared the king of Palmyra and is actually declared the king of kings in 263, which is a title that I would like someday, please and thank you. So, of course, this means that Zenobia is risen up.
Queen of queens.
Remember, she does also have the other, right? He names his first son Herodinus. From the first wife to be his co-ruler. But that doesn't last very long. In 267, Odenathus and his eldest son are assassinated by palace intrigue.
What is up with this palace intrigue?
You can't trust anyone.
Wow.
Heavy as the head.
Yeah. You know?
Especially when it falls off your shoulders.
Especially when it's the king of kings. It's mm-hmm. the head of heads.
Literally. So some stories say that Zenobia had a hand in it. There are other stories that say she wasn't even there when it happened. Mm. What we do know is that after this, she is successful in installing her son as the new emperor, who is 10 at the time.
Okay.
So
I'm thinking she had something to do with it now.
Well, she gets herself named regent.
Duh.
So she's essentially now
the ruler
in charge.
Great.
Right. And this is a transition of power that is very smooth, which is one of the reasons why people think that it was that she may have had a hand in the assassination of her husband.
Right.
Because it was just kind of like, okay, now I'm
Now I'm in charge.
Now this is in.
Yeah.
Now that she is queen regent, Zenobia takes advantage of this weakness in the Roman Empire and starts taking territory from Rome. She starts going around the edges of the Roman Empire and taking pieces off of it. By the time Rome comes for her, the Palmyrene Empire reaches its peak under her rule.
I mean, duh. Did we see anything else coming? This is what happened when ladies are in charge, people.
There's a map. Here, look. This is the map.
Okay.
It's the entire Egyptian coastline going down into the Red, from the Mediterranean all the way down into the Red Sea, stretching all the way up into northern Turkey. I mean, she has the entire western little foot of the Mediterranean.
Can I just say, I've never heard of Palmyra. I've never heard of it.
You know where you might have heard of it is in 2017 when ISIS started destroying World Heritage Sites.
That was
the sites of Palmyra. Yeah. By 270, she takes control of Egypt. She takes the city of Alexandria.
Are you kidding me?
But unfortunately for her, in 270, Lucius Domitius Aurelianus takes control of the Roman Empire and proves a match for Zenobia, partially because she names herself Caesar and her son.
Are you kidding
Caesar.
Me? She changes her name to Caesar, or she's just like, I am emperor now.
Well, she was going around doing this under the guise of being a conquest for the Roman Empire. So she was saying, I'm still a city-state for Rome. I'm doing all of this and my son is imperator, which means emperor. Right. But it did not mean Emperor Caesar, which meant like the head ruler. Emperor was the emperors. Exactly. Imperator was the name that they gave to like the heads of military regiments.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually she just was like, okay, well.
Oh, just kidding.
Actually. And so
now that I've like Trojan horsed my way into this.
Exactly. And so the actual minting of coins, they ended up taking the actual emperor of Rome off the coins, and they would put her son on one side and her on the other side.
Yes, queen.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. So Lucius Domitius Aurelianus sends troops to Syria first.
Yikes.
And successfully pushes Zenobia and all of her troops back from Syria and back to Antioch, or back into Palmyra. The march eventually reaches them in 272. And Zenobia sends this message, apparently, to Aurelian, saying, from Zenobia, queen of the East, to Aurelian Augustus, you demand my surrender as though you were not aware that Cleopatra preferred to die a queen rather than remain alive, however high her rank. So this pisses Aurelian off because
That's
he's now
amazing.
Been spurned by a woman.
That's the most amazing letter. I don't know if you've heard of this woman named Cleopatra, but I'm basically her, so bye.
Remember how Cleopatra died? I'm ready to do it, so come for me. Unfortunately, this causes Aurelian to fight even harder. The queen attempts to flee Palmyra east to Asia, to Persia, and is actually captured because he sends riders ahead of them and is able to get her before they fully go through. And that's really kind of the last instance that we hear from her. We don't exactly know what happens to her definitively from this point. We do know that Palmyra is basically reduced back to what it was before she was put in charge of it.
Yeah.
Some stories say that she was married off to a Roman senator and she lived out her life in Rome. Some stories say that she was killed quietly in execution, but the story wasn't allowed to get out because Aurelian wanted people to think that he was merciful and that he allowed her to survive and to live. There are some who say that she killed herself before she could be taken.
I like that one.
So we're not exactly sure what happened. I want to finish with this quote from The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which was written by Edward Gibbon in a six-volume. This was a six-volume work.
Oh, well, it's the rise and the fall.
No, it's just the history of the decline and fall.
Oh.
In six volumes.
Oops.
Whoa. Quote, modern Europe has produced several illustrious women who have sustained with glory the weight of empire. Nor is our own age dissolute of such distinguished characters. Zenobia is perhaps the only female whose superior genius broke through the servile indolence imposed on her sex. Zenobia was esteemed the most lovely as well as the most heroic of her sex. Her manly understanding strengthened and adorned by study.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a statement.
For real. So really just a woman taking charge and saying, this is mine now. And not even saying like, oh, you need someone to come in and do it. No, she took power. Yeah. She successfully installed her son.
She didn't bring a chair. She brought an army.
She brought a throne.
Yeah, pretty much.
She brought a throne.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready for Catherine Switzer?
Yes, I'm ready.
Catherine Switzer is a more contemporary woman than Zenobia. Way more contemporary.
Probably about 1,800 years difference or so.
Probably. So we're just going to kind of jump right into, because she has a biography out and or an autobiography and a website. So we're kind of going to kind of like into the,
different.
Yeah, very different. I don't know if she has coins, but we're going to just kind of jump right into that because
she's still alive today.
Cause she's still alive today.
Okay.
And doing a lot of really cool things. So we're going to just focus on like the one moment.
Okay.
The moment.
Okay.
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 But she was born January 5th, 1947 in Germany. Her father was a major in the United States Army. So the family returns to the United States in 1949. That's where she lived all growing up, but she was born in Germany. So one night, when she was getting ready to go to high school in Virginia, she announced to her family that she wanted to be a cheerleader next year.
Okay.
And her dad said, you don't want to be a cheerleader. You want people to cheer for you. The game is on the
yes.
field. Life is about participating, not being a spectator.
Oh my God.
So shout out to the dads.
Yes.
Shout out to the dads.
The game is on the field.
Yeah. You don't want to be a cheerleader. You want people to cheer for you. Yes, Dad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You are right.
Yeah.
So cut to, again, major cut to, Catherine falls in love with running, and she is attending Syracuse University, where there is no women's cross-country team. Of course. It's mm-hmm. the 60s.
Sure.
But she's invited to practice with the boys' team.
Mm-hmm.
So she began to train unofficially with the men's cross-country team, and the coach was a 50-year-old named Arnie, and he had trained years with the men's team. And he was actually the university mailman, but a veteran of 15 Boston marathons, and he
wow.
was excited to see a woman come out to run, got her involved in all of the training sessions, and he would tell and retell all of these stories of Boston marathons. Catherine loved listening to them. One night, she just says, let's quit talking about the Boston Marathon. Let's go and run it. And he says, no woman can run the Boston Marathon. And she says, why not? I'm running 10 miles a night. Like,
right.
why can I not go run a marathon? Which, fun fact, if you were only running 10 miles like 4 days a week, you have done enough to do a marathon.
Yeah.
If you're doing like low end of training or low impact training or whatever.
Says the person who ran 27 miles this
but
morning.
But I am not training to run a marathon. I'm training to run much further. I'm just saying she's accurate
sure.
in saying like running
yeah,
10 miles
absolutely.
A night. If she's doing that 5 nights a week, that's 50 miles a week. You can easily
also,
run a marathon.
Also, the
on
blanket
that.
Statement of, no woman
well,
can run the
well,
marathon.
So it used to be thought, this is great, this is not from Catherine's
book. What, that her
book.
Uterus would fall
yes,
out?
Yes, did you know that? That was a real thing.
No, I just made that up.
No, but that's real.
Oh my
so
God.
Women were not allowed to run long distance because male doctors were like, oh my God, your uterus will fall out. Which is not
wait, wait, wait.
Even a
Are
thing.
You serious?
I
just
am,
made
no,
that
I
up
am
to
serious.
Joke.
No, I am serious. I am 100% serious. That's why women were not allowed to run distance. Now, what's fascinating...
What the actual...
And that I learned from a TED Talk by Christopher McDougall, who wrote the wonderful book Born to Run, which
uh-huh.
if you haven't read it, it's an amazing book.
Mm-hmm.
And he was giving a speech and talking about long distance running and all these things. And yes, women were not allowed to participate in marathons because people were worried that... It might not be as dramatic as like your uterus would fall out, but it was basically like you'll destroy your uterus and your sexual function. And by sexual function, we really mean making babies, because who cares about your sexual function?
Right.
You're a woman.
Right.
And so women were not allowed to run distance. What's fascinating, though, is that in general, in the like years that women have now been allowed to participate in marathons and in 50Ks and 50 miles and long, much longer races, is women are actually becoming faster very quickly and catching up to men's times very quickly in distance, even though they've only been allowed to participate in, like, the women's marathon was first in the Olympics in 1984, thanks to Catherine Switzer, spoiler alert. So that's what, like,
35 years.
Mm-hmm. So in only 35 years, women have really come a long way in terms of marathon speed and distance. And women generally are considered better distance runners than men.
Interesting.
Probably because our endurance is pretty up there. Also, our pain tolerance pretty up there, because we have to, like, grow a human and then push it out of our bodies. So we're like, oh, run 200 miles? That's really not a problem.
But it also makes, I mean, where do you think we came from? Like, if you're a doctor who has any understanding of human evolution, we women and men were running across the plains of Africa together.
Yes.
Running from huge animals.
Well, but,
and somehow the human species survived and thousands and thousands of years. Tens of thousands of years.
Running to catch the huge animals.
Yeah, exactly.
And women needed to be there, because who benefits most from protein is nursing and pregnant mothers
exactly.
and children.
Sometimes jokes get too real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that you knew that. That's why
not.
You said that, but that is why.
I did not.
Arnie insisted that the distance was too long for fragile women to run, and Catherine said, well, this woman, Roberta Gibb, had jumped into the race and finished it the previous April.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no dame ever ran the Boston Marathon. Then he said, if any woman could do it, you could, but you would have to prove it to me. If you ran the distance in practice, I'd be the first to take you to Boston. And she thought, great.
Cool.
Awesome.
Want to go now?
Yeah. You ready? So 3 weeks before the marathon, Arnie and Catherine ran a 26-mile trial. And as they were wrapping up, she said, felt great. Felt a little bit too easy. So she suggests that they run another 5-mile loop just to feel extra confident.
Mm-hmm.
Arnie agrees reluctantly. So towards the end of their 31-mile run, he was not doing great.
Mm.
He passes out. She's like, bye. I'm good. I'm going back to my dorm. So the next day, Arnie comes to her dorm.
She just leaves him there, passed out.
I don't know. It doesn't say. So the next day, Arnie comes to her dorm and insists that she sign up for the race. And he said it would be wrong to run without registering, and that she could get into trouble with the Amateur Athletic Union. So they check the rule book, and there's actually nothing in the rule book or the entry form about gender in the marathon.
Hmm.
So she fills out the form, she pays the entry fee, she signs her name as she always signed her name, KV Switzer, and went to the university infirmary, got a fitness certificate, and then you get travel permits, entries mailed in, they're ready to go. 2 weeks later, Catherine and her boyfriend at the time, who was a 235-pound ex-All-American football player and nationally ranked hammer thrower,
sure,
known as Big Tom Miller, announced that he was going to run the Boston Marathon too, but he didn't need to train because if a girl can run a marathon, I can run a marathon. Tom, seriously?
Tom.
Seriously, Tom.
Let's talk.
let me just tell you right now, you are wrong.
That's not how this works.
But, I mean, he was in pretty good shape. He was a football player. Whatever. They had pre-entered the race as a team, and so the race organizers had all the stuff together for the team captain. So Arnie goes and checks in, brings back the envelope with all the bibs. They pin them on, and they just see K. Switzer, 261. That's it. Nothing else. Everybody's kind of milling about at the start of the race. Nobody's really paying attention, but some people did notice that, oh, like, this is a woman. This is kind of weird. And she would just kind of smile and wave and be like, yeah, I'm a girl. And a lot of the guys, she says, would come over and say things like, are you gonna go the whole way, or it's great to see a girl here. Can you give some tips to get my wife to run? She'd love it if I could just get her started. Arnie was like, oh, this girl can run me into the ground. And he says, you know, see, I told you you'd be very welcome in Boston. There's not gonna be a problem. Famous last words.
Right.
They check off the bib numbers as the runners came through the gate. She just lifted up like her outer sweatshirt because it was cold. Mm-hmm. It's Boston in April. And they just said, yep, 261. Okay, great. And they passed her on. So Arnie said, see, no problem. Here we go. We're running. They're running the first few miles. The crowd is watching. Everything's very excited. And then around mile 4, there was a big like honking of horns behind them and people shouting to get over. And the press van was coming by. So everybody that's got the film cameras, photo cameras, right, everybody covering the race in this big truck is going past. And just a little bit after that, Catherine hears behind her the scraping noise of leather shoes coming up behind her. And a huge man grabs her and says, get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers. And reaches out and tries to grab her bib number off the front.
Get out of my race.
Well, it was the race organizer. You find out later. Because somebody he was on the press van and somebody was like, hey, there's a woman running your race. And he like jumped off the van
right
to try and grab her
He had a panic.
Yeah. So he wasn't able to grab the bib, but he had the back of her shirt and he was swiping at the bib number on her back because you put them on your back and your front.
Mm-hmm.
And he just like wouldn't let her go. And she was trying to see what she could do. And Arnie came over and was saying, you know, leave her alone. I've trained her. She's okay. He and Jock, the race organizer, mm-hmm, were friends. And he's like, she's totally fine. Big Tom, the hammer thrower,
right,
comes in.
Thank you. Where you been, boy?
Yep. And body slams Jock out of the way. He lands on the roadside. And Arnie looks at Catherine and just says, shouts, run like hell. And so she's just like, okay, I'm off. So she runs the whole thing. Of course, the journalists who've taken photos and videos of all of this going down are shouting, go after her, go after her. So the van is going. She's running. Arnie was so upset about this because his friend Jock Semple, who's the race organizer, he's like, he should know better. He's a runner. This is terrible. But she's talks in the book about how really upset she was and how she was kind of thinking she might not finish the race because obviously she's terrified. Somebody's jumped out of nowhere and attacked her for no reason. And she just felt embarrassed, mm-hmm, obviously, and really was thinking that they didn't want to finish. But she keeps going. The finish line was maybe like a dozen people by the time that she got there and the whole group got there because, I mean, things slowed them down a little bit.
Yeah.
Little bit. And none of the people were very excited. They didn't really clap for her. And all of these journalists were waiting. And she says, like, being a journalism student, this what amused her the most is she could tell that the journalists felt indignant about having to cover a girl. She could just, like, see right through it. She said they all asked her, like, the same question. What made you do it? She says, I like to run. The longer, the better. Why Boston? Why wear numbers? She said women deserve to run too, equal rights and all that. You know, will you come back and run again? Yes, they will ban your club. She says, then we'll change the name of our club. And then one journalist asked her, are you a suffragette? And she said, huh, I thought we got the right to vote in 1920. So to her, though, her greatest achievement was getting the women's marathon into the Olympics in 1984. Because the photos of her, we'll have to get Jess to put them up on the Instagram, but like the photos of her running and this guy like trying to grab her and pull her, literally pull her out of the race, really that became the story and the big moment. Not necessarily finishing or winning or anything like that, but just like the drama of it. And she
I've seen that picture. Yeah. I know that picture.
Yeah. And that's the story.
Right.
And what I like about it, and what I really enjoyed about like looking on her website and reading the some of the excerpts from her book, is just like the honesty mm-hmm. of that feeling of like, I don't know if I want to finish now. I'm embarrassed. I'm scared. I don't know if I can do it. I mean, let alone running 26 miles in the Boston Marathon. Mm-hmm. How about doing it after somebody attacks you out of nowhere?
Yeah.
Especially when the rule book doesn't even say that women can't run. So ridiculous.
Right. What a moment.
I know.
Yeah.
If you are enjoying listening to this podcast and hearing about all these incredible moments from women's history, ancient history, modern history, and everything in between, do us a favor and leave us a rating or review on whatever platform that you're listening on, because those ratings and reviews help other people find the show, which is how we get to keep doing the show. Thanks.
Cause of the week?
I was thinking we should do 261 Fearless,
okay.
Obviously, in honor of Catherine. 261 Fearless because her number was 261,
right.
And Fearless because, oh, she was fearless.
Right.
And 261 Fearless is a social running network for women from their website. They are a global supportive social running network which empowers women to connect and take control of their lives through the freedom gained by running. Through a series of non-competitive running clubs, unique education program, and private communication channels, we provide networking, healthy running support, and a sisterhood to women all over the world. It is the mission of 261 Fearless to bring active women together through a global supportive social running network, allowing fearless women to pass strength gained from running onto women who are facing challenges, and in sparking a revolution of empowerment. 261 is the symbol that unites us as empowered runners.
Yes.
And they are at 261fearless.org. That's the number 261 and then the word fearless.org.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Well, that'll do it for another episode of The Bitchery of History. If you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can find us on Facebook.
Just search The Bitchery of History.
On Twitter.
Search The Bitchery of History.
And on Instagram.
Search The Bitchery of History.
You can also find us at thebitcheryofhistory.com.
We could not make this show happen without our incredible team. So thank you to Jess,
Sydney,
and Jeanette.
And remember, bitches get stuff done.